it to me.
When that song, first of all, welcome to the June 6th edition of Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, where real men don't play. The song that initiated the show for tonight was a Motown artist by the name of Edwin Starr. And when that song came out, this country was torn apart because of the Vietnam War. Preceding that song was June 4th, 1967. Cleveland, Ohio, Euclid Avenue, in the offices of the Black Economic Union. The next voice you will hear sat in on a series of meetings that we'll be discussing as we look backwards in order to move forwards. Welcome to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, Brother Walter Beach.
Thank you, Bobby. Uncle.
Now, I know that's kind of, yeah, that's a stretch for you to call me Uncle Bobby.
No, I'm all right with it, man. I'm good.
Man, right. I really appreciate you taking time out of your struggle daily. At 84 years old, you're still sharper than a mother-in-law's tongue, and I want to take advantage of the fact that you're a walking piece of history. As we turn the clock back, all the way back to 1964, the fall, the early, I guess the summer, actually, of 1964, when you were in camp at the facility of the Cleveland Browns. And a decision had to be made as to whether or not you were going to be a part of that team. So what year actually did you join the Cleveland Browns, Walter?
I joined the Browns in 63.
Okay.
1963. I'd been 2 years in the American Football League with the Boston Patriots.
Oh, okay. Okay. And could you describe the scenario wherein you were at the point of being released by the Browns, and what happened at that point?
Oh, basically, I was told to come down and bring my book, playbook. You know, that's the property of the Browns.
Mm-hmm.
And, I went down. And when I got down there, basically they said, management said, "Well, we're not going with you. We decided to go another direction and deal with some different talent on the team." So I accepted that reluctantly and left to go back up to my room to pack so that I could go on my way to back to Pontiac, Michigan. I was no longer a member of the team. And as I was packing, Jim came by, Jim Brown, and he called me, he said, "Doc," you know. And that's why everybody calls me Doctor, but it's really Doc, it's just, you know. But that's okay. But he said, "Doc," he said, "let's go to practice." I said, "Man, I'm just been placed on waiver." He says, "Oh, man, come on," he said, "let's go to practice. Stop fooling around." So I said, "No, man, I'm I don't know what the language to use on your program," but I said, "Man, you see, I'm packing my shit, don't you?"
That'll work, yeah.
So I'm leaving. He said, "Oh no, man." So he said, "Stay here. I'll be right back." So he went back. He came back in about a half an hour, 45 minutes. He said, "Let's go to practice." So I said, "Man, they done told me they put me on waiver." He said. And you have to understand, Jim is kind of aggressive in the way that he deals with things. So he grabs me by the arm and almost literally drags me down to the to the locker room. And it was it was just a difficult situation for me, because when I get down, there, they putting my stuff back in my helmet and all my stuff back into the locker. And you know, man, I go out on the field and it's difficult, man. I don't know what to do. But I go on and participate and I stay with the team. And of course, I started at the corner, and we were successful for a couple years. The first year, '64, we won the championship, and then to run the world, we became the world champions. And then '65, we lost the championship game to the Green Bay Packers.
Let me share with my audience something, Brother Beach. In my hometown resides a man who is arguably one of the greatest wide receivers to ever play in the NFL by the name of Raymond Berry. And I think I shared that story personally with you, but I want to share it with my audience. I had an opportunity to spend some time with Raymond Berry, and he went back to that 64 World Championship game where the Baltimore Colts lost to the Cleveland Browns 27-0. And he told me, once he knew that I knew you, he said, "You tell Walter and Jim I wish they had a cutting, because we would have probably retained that world championship, because he didn't." I think he caught maybe what, one pass that day or two at the most?
No, he caught three passes for probably a total of about 8 or 9, 10 yards. Yeah. And I intercepted one, so fair exchange, we ain't no robbery.
Well, you know, like I said, that was the first thing that he told me. He said, "Man, if you ever talk to Dr. Walter Beach, let him know I wish they'd have cut him, because I'd have broke loose on him had he not been on the field that day." And that became one of the most historic championship games ever, because you guys were the underdog in that particular game. And so with that said, let's fast forward 3 years. Euclid Avenue, June 4th, 1967, which was 50 years ago, 2 days ago. And before the actual summit was convened, what was it like to be in that environment? Because it was held in what at the time was the Negro Industrial Economic Union headquarters, correct?
Yeah, that was Jim's creative idea. Black Economic Union.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were trying to do was to get individuals to be more conscious and disciplined about economics in their lives. So, but that's one of the positive things you can say about Jim. He's always making those sincere efforts to help black people, help our people. And I usually say this, Bobby, if you don't mind. I usually take about 90 seconds to tell people who I am.
Please go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, so always, I just spoke to the Eagle Academy in Queens about a week ago. And I always share this word. I said, "I'm black in attitude, I'm black in behavior, I'm black in belief and thought. I am African in spirit. I accept and acknowledge the fact of my African self being intuitively, and have developed the cognitive strength to function as a black man in America. As an African black man, my hypocrisy manifests a silent rage. I must decide what my relationship to racism will be. There is no hint of civility in my makeup. I am not afraid to identify with myself. I am a man of peace and love. I am a man of my people. The more profound question is, what is my need to be anything other than a black man?" And then I recite this from the Hosea, which is an ancient book called Divine Utterance. "I do not speak falsely, for I am great. I do not act lightly, for I have weight. I am not untrue, for I am the balance. And I do not swerve, for I am the standard." And those individuals that you saw in that picture, we were the standard.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, please finish your thought. I apologize.
No, I just said, and we didn't act lightly.
And you didn't act likely. I'm looking at the picture right now, and front row, left to right, is the great Bill Russell, the late great Muhammad Ali, the great Jim Brown, and a young kid at the time known as Lew Alcindor, now known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And then the second row to the immediate left from my vantage point is a gentleman who became the first black mayor in the United States, if I'm not mistaken, Carl Stokes. Then as the young Dr. Walter Beach, it looks like Curtis McClendon standing next to him. No, it's not Curtis McClendon.
No, that's Bobby Mitchell.
Bobby Mitchell. And who is that standing next to Bobby Mitchell?
Sidney Williams.
Sidney Williams. You know, that's funny because that's Maxine Waters' husband. Yeah.
Right.
And that's Curtis McClendon standing next to him, right?
Right.
The great Willie Davis. And who is the gentleman to his right?
Jim Shorter.
And then there's Big John Wooden, who also played with you on the Cleveland Browns. And as I look at that picture, the sternness in you guys' face, what does that reflect in, as you look at that picture and back at that particular news conference?
Well, basically what we were serious about the struggle. And we had come to terms with the reality of what was happening with the champ. And the champ was probably the most... magnificent man that I've ever come in contact with in terms of having integrity and not swerving from his position.
So let me ask you a question before we get back into the progression of events leading up to the summit. You grew up in Pontiac, Michigan in an era. What year were you born?
1933, January the 31st,
1933. Man, that was several worlds ago. What was it like growing up in Michigan in the 30s and 40s?
Yeah, well, Pontiac was a segregated segregated north. You know, we was in a highly segregated city. The blessings of Pontiac were probably two, and that was the whole aspect of the community, the neighborhood that I grew up in. So had some excellent values that I accepted. And the other value was that Pontiac Central High School was a school where all of the executives of General Motors' children went to school, so the school was integrated. So I got a classic education, you know, so I'm, you know, in terms of reading Shakespeare and Hamlet and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales and Beowulf, the Iliad, the Odyssey, by Homer. So we were blessed to that extent.
So, that became, that explains your formal education process. The roots of your activism, when did they begin to sprout, so to speak?
Well, I come up in a community that was full of love and respect. So therefore, and most of the individuals, everything, even though it was an integrated city, my community or neighborhood was... the general store was owned by a black man, the barber shop, everything. My father lived there. My father never went to the movie, and I'd ask him why he never went to the movie. He said he wasn't going to pay nobody to be segregated.
Mm.
So we had to go to the back of the theater. But at that particular time, I liked Roy Rogers and Johnny McBrown and Lash LaRue.
I've heard of those guys. I remember Roy Rogers.
All the white cowboys.
Right. Know? Right.
Yeah, so that's what, you know, so we rooted for the cowboys and as opposed to the Indians.
Little did we know.
Yeah, at that time.
I can relate to that part of it. You know, let's again, you know, fast forward to the build up to the summit. Kind of take us through the sequence of events from your very unique vantage point, how that actually ended up culminating in an assembly of some of the most well-known athletes in the world at that time, who happened to be black as well, standing behind Ali on that day, June 4th, 1967.
Well, you know, with Jim's idea to get in touch with the champ, he had a relationship with the champ, and he asked John Wooten, he said, get these guys, man, and have them come in here and let us talk to Ali and find out what his position is, so we could articulate it and support him. So, you know, the real interesting thing was kind of all of those athletes that you see on that picture came from all over the country. And not one of them asked for their flight to be paid, asked for their hotels to be paid for. They did this out of their own pocket. Everybody there moved, and that's what that commitment is, man. That's what the commitment is necessary for us to deal with. And to support that, you know, intellectually is that one of the things, it's what I call the collective racial memory or consciousness. That's what sustained us through the middle passage, slavery, the Black Code, Jim Crow, segregation, and racial oppression. Was there the collective racial memory, so we knew who we were, and we didn't have to validate ourselves. So we just took that position, that's the position that we lived by at that time, and that's the position I live by today. Is that don't ask any particular quarters and don't give any. I don't need nobody's permission to live and be a sovereign and free human being.
So, in the time that it took to gather that august body of brothers, what was your frame of mind as it amped up? Because at some point, I guess it was a rumor, and people began to talk about it. And at some point, were you asked not to participate in it by anybody, or did you feel any internal pressure not to participate?
Well, no one asked me personally, but speaking first person. So no one asked me personally not to participate, but it wouldn't have mattered to me anyway, because I was committed to doing that which is right. And I think that if I'm not mistaken, I think Bobby Mitchell and Jim and myself, we had all been in the military anyway, so we had served the country. And I served the country as a young man, so all of those myths and fallacies that I'd bought into earlier. And it never occurred to me that anything could happen negative in that light, but it didn't matter.
You know,
you've heard it in the street, man. You got to stand for something or you'll go for anything.
You're right about that. And let's kind of just revisit 1967. There had been the riots in Newark, and in 65 they'd had the riots here in the Los Angeles area in Watts. What was the climate like in the city of Cleveland as it related to the war and the growing dissent and just the general mood of the people in Cleveland?
Well, you know, they had a riot in Cleveland, Glenville riot.
In 67?
I think it was 68.
Oh, okay.
It was 68, they had the Glenville. They had the riots in Cleveland, you know. But there's not much difference in the cities across the country. So you're talking about a psychological and spiritual paradigm of racism and white supremacy. So it's not made any difference, you know. I have a friend of mine, he always say, man, he said, the circus stays the same. He said, only the clowns change.
Oh, my goodness. So what was going through your mind, though, as you knew that at some point this was going to come to a head? I mean, were you taking into account the fact that you had a family to feed and that this could possibly alter your life adversely for the rest of your life?
That's always something that you entertain. And I had a wonderful wife at that time. She's since passed. And I had a wife and three children. But she he had supported me anyway, because, you know, I came into the Cleveland Browns. I was 30 years old as a rookie with the Browns.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came in, I had been a school teacher, and best job I ever had, the most exciting experience I ever had, and if I could have afforded to teach school, that's what I would have done. You know, we give teachers $45,000 a year, and we pay athletes $40 million.
Mm-hmm.
Something's wrong with that, man. Something's wrong with that. But that's just the way it was. But, we were. I think the major question to ask, Bobby, that very few people ask was I or some of the other guys really concerned about the fact that they were jeopardizing their particular job or employment? I think the more profound question to ask is, what kind of country would put you in that position? That you'd have to really worry about your job for trying to be an ethical and moral human being. That's the question that don't nobody want to touch.
Well, now that we've touched that, it also heightens, I think, the significance of the men in that picture, in that room, and of that state of mind, who were able to somehow compartmentalize that in a way that it didn't deter them from doing what they thought was the right thing to do.
I had a gentleman call me 2 days ago, man, to talk about the same issue. And my response to him when he asked me, he said, well, I said, why are you calling me, man? He said, because you were on that picture with the Cleveland Browns, you know. I said, yeah, but there's probably been a million football players since then. You ain't calling them. See, so what I'm saying in terms of making that statement is that football is what I did. That ain't who I am. Boxing is what Muhammad Ali did, but that wasn't who he was. And once you can understand that with your life, and your life got purpose, man, life's got to have purpose. That's one of the reasons that I love Jim, because Jim has purpose when it comes to what he's doing to help young people across this country.
You know, we're gonna take a short break, and then afterwards we're gonna get into some of the things that happened in your life in the interim after you left professional football and that whole arena. But I did want to kind of hone in on what you just said about the difference between what you do and who you are. You say that so consistently and steadfastly that a lot of people that don't understand, I've had an opportunity to sit with the elders, know that that's a totally different mindset than the one that prevails today. And I say that in the following construct. Since I've had the honor of knowing you all these many years and being around you and Bill Russell and some of these other brothers, y'all say that so matter-of-factly that it sometimes doesn't really resonate the way that we have to have it resonate with young people. And so when we come back from this short break, I want to get into how do we embed in young people that same kind of resolve to solve problems, make better decisions, and then be able to find that common ground with people who look like them in order to elevate the quality of our lives. So we're going to take a real short break. Stay on the line, brother, and we'll be right back. Ball of Confusion by The Tempting Temptations, because that's what the world is today. Hey, hey.
You know what Neely Fuller says?
What?
Using this saying, Neely Fuller says, if you do not understand white supremacy and racism and how it works, everything else you understand will only confuse you.
You know, a couple other quick questions about the era and the impact of the Ali Summit and the elevation of the bar, so to speak, in terms of what it looks like if you find a true and sustained level of black unity. As you guys sit in that room with Ali, and he fielded the questions as to the authenticity of his position on refusing to go to the Vietnam War, what was the turning point in terms of creating the consensus that you guys would take the next step, which was the press conference announcing your collective support?
Again, the individual that was leading all that was Jim. So, you know, and he we had discussions about what could possibly be the benefits of it. And from that point on, after we listened to Ali, and there was not a lot of resistance, but everybody had their own opinions about it, you know. And It wasn't a real, what I would consider a real sophisticated or complicated situation. You know, there's only three situations that exist, man. It's simple. Cooking biscuits is simple. Then it's complicated. Going to the moon is complicated. Then it's complex. Raising children are complex. Dealing with other human beings, that's complex. So That was everybody had their voice, and it was kind of orchestrated and manipulated for that kind of support. So we all, we different people do different things differently. That's why I don't have any. I have a lot of people ask me about the athletes of the day. I can't make no discussion. I can't get in no discussion about the athletes of the day. I don't live the life they live. I haven't been where they've been. They haven't done what I've done. So I don't make no judgments about it. I just try to keep things simple and deal with the truth, man. Whatever the truth is, that's where I want to try to wind up. The truth is, when I was growing up and you were growing up, stealing was stealing. Killing was killing. Lying was lying. Cheating was cheating. And then none of that's changed.
Right.
So we always knew when you grew up and you was in the inner city or in the hood, you always knew who the thieves were. Not everybody was a thief, but you always knew who the crooks were. Not everybody was a crook. You always knew who the phony people were. So, you know, those are the things that you have to make the adjustment for as you live. So in that particular body, with that particular group of individuals. See, what people don't really understand, Bobby, or don't want to understand, is that Ali wasn't loved, the man. When Ali was doing all that, when he did, at his funeral, I heard all these people talking about how great and magnificent Ali was. They ain't the same people. They wasn't talking about that one Ali, and I'm not just talking about white people, I'm talking about black people. They didn't have all that love and compassion for Ali.
You know,
he was taking an unpopular position.
You know, you also had a chance to be around some of the great black scholars and true leaders in your lifetime. Dr. John Henry Clark, amongst them. You had a chance to meet Malcolm X and some of the other key people of the 1960s and 70s. And the reason I want to have this segment of the conversation is that, again, you say some things matter-of-factly that is far more important in terms of trying to get young people to at least appreciate the severity of life and the consequences of not being active in your own self-determination. So, just for example, you know, you talked almost matter-of-factly about how you guys sit around and came to a consensus that didn't involve a whole lot of, well, what about my job and I got a shoe deal and all that kind of stuff. And here today, those kind of things have become inhibitors from the modern athlete being more socially conscious in a sustainable way, which leads me to a question about your perception or reaction to what happened to Colin Kaepernick when he decided that he wouldn't honor the playing of the national anthem in protest of how black people were being treated.
Well, you know, there was a couple things about about Colin. You know, I didn't have any position that what he was doing other than what he believed he was supposed to do. And to speak about that in matter-of-fact terms, I stood up for the national anthem, put my hand over my heart. So what I'm saying, at a particular time and at a particular point, you have to get a different understanding. There's levels of consciousness. And the other thing that you were talking about shoe deals, you know, I was never in a position to be considered or invited into a shoe deal. But my father told me something one time, and he and I used to talk, and he always used to ask me certain things. And one of the things he asked me is, do you want something, or do you want to be something? And that's what I wrestled with. Wrong is wrong, right is right, right don't wrong nobody, and wrong don't right nobody.
Let's play the tape back. You said your father said the difference between wanting something and what?
Do you want something?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to be something?
What's the difference?
Well, I might want a shoe contract, but I want to be a decent human being, and if being a decent human being was antithetical to the shoe deal, then I would choose the decent human being, the moral and ethical human being, not the shoe deal. But if you live in a society now, people have been socialized and conditioned for material gain and not for real meaningful gains, you know. I don't know what the young people go through. But can you imagine having a friend like Jim Brown for 50 years? That's going to always be there. Kareem, Sidney, these guys are still in my life, you know. These are friends. He's not associates. These are friends and people that you know. Jim and I had a discussion one time. Jim said to me, he said, man, he said, you qualified. So in relationships, you have to qualify people. Not certified them. You're not, you know, that's why I said about that little thing I put on your website about the reason that, you know, is that it'd be highly disrespect to diminish individuals with honorary doctor's degrees or academic degrees as a doctor. So I just said, they just call me doctor. But I don't represent myself as at the level, because I know John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, Alipe Asante, Marimba Ani, Francis Chess Welby. I've been in all of his presence. So I wouldn't want to try to steal their thunder, but they've all helped me grow as I read their works and research what they're doing to help our people. So that's just something that, you know, that I live by, and I don't require or even request that other people do what I do. I do it because that's who I am. And if they want to do other than that, you know. So Bobby, I'm probably, and I'm a race man, and I'm conscious, but I'm indifferent to a racist. I don't care what racist thinks. Now, I'm not indifferent to racism, but I'm indifferent to a racist. It doesn't matter to me what they think or what they do, as long as it don't have no impact on me immediately or secondary or tertiary. Then I'm fine with the way it is. You know, like I said, I was fine living in my community. I was fine, you know, with my neighbors. So I've never been anyone to, I've never pursued any particular aspect of integration or to be accepted.
Let me ask you this question. After football, and let's kind of go fast forward for real, to the late 80s when Jim formed the American Foundation for Social Change. What prompted you to become a part of that and ultimately the director of the East Coast operations of the American program?
Well, it was a conference. Jim Brown was there. I was living in Brooklyn, and Jim Brown came there to talk to, I think it was the Jackie Robinson Foundation. It was then his that program, the AmeriCAN, and I was in the audience because a friend of mine. You may not know it. The education of Sonny Carson.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Sonny Carson, I brought the Black Circus into Brooklyn because I was the chief of recreation for the borough of Brooklyn. And Sonny Carson said, "Man, come go with me." I said, "Where you going?" He said, "Just come on, go." I didn't know Jim was there, but when I got there. Then I saw Jim, and he said, "Doc," he said, "Man, what you doing?" I told him. He said, "I'd like for you to be part of AmeriCAN." I said, "Well, let me look at it, man. I'd be more than interested." See, but I was the training director. I was the training director for the New York City of Department of Correction. So I had been all over the country before and worked on Rikers Island for training correction officers. So I was familiar with about 12 to 13 different training modalities. So when Jim gave me his speech with the mayor, I looked at it, and then he sent Tony in, who was one of his trainers, and he spent 2 weeks at my house and trained me in that curriculum, profound and powerful curriculum. And it should be in all the schools in this country. It really should be, for the way that it has an impact on getting young people to understand what their role is in the society and the culture. So that's how. So after reading, I said, "Man, I'd like to be part of it." He said, "Okay," and that's how. That's why we got together on that. So I'm still doing some training in the curriculum.
What aspects of the 15 chapters has had the most impact on the way that you comport yourself on a daily basis?
Probably the 13 rules. First of the 13 rules is speak in the first person. Use the word I. Don't speak for others. So what I'm telling you now and what I'm saying, I'm just telling you this is who I am. So I don't need to be in a situation where I'm going to be anything other than who I am. And why that has such an impact is that what we find in our community is everybody's looking for some excuse or some reason or something. So if you were to tell me that you didn't like Jim Brown, my position would be, "Well, all right, man, all right, so you don't like him. But I don't want you to be a hypocrite. I don't want you to start smiling. So you speak, if that's what you believe, then you should be able to say that." Speak in the first person, use the word I. That's what I do. I speak in the first, and when I'm saying, that's what I say. The only position you can be that nobody can challenge you in terms of your validity about who you are. Nobody can tell me who I am. Nobody can tell you who you are. That's not consistent in this society. Because people are always trying to tell you, you know. I walk the street as a black man. But there's some information out there or some stereotype that's telling people that I'm who I am. Because I'm black, with thick lips and a broad nose and dreadlocks. That means that I'm a gangster. If you really want to look at the gangsters, man, and I don't want to go off on that, but all you got to do is look at, who the gangsters and the gang people are. The gangsters are the people who sit in them congresses and senators. They're the ones that steal the money. They're the ones taking countries away.
That's some real talk there, Brother Beach. You know, What are some of the things that, from your vantage point, people of color need to spend most of their waking time focusing upon?
Well, one of the things, man, and I say this in all disrespect, I mean, in all respect to you, and I think I said it earlier, I don't use the word people of color, because I'm not a person of color, I'm a black man. And once you get at the cross section of trying to deal with all of those diverse types of groups, then the essence of who you are is diminished. Because, you know, they talk about the transgender, the gays and the homosexuals and all that. You get lost in that, man. You won't find out who you are or where you belong in that nonsense. So that's me. But I think one of the things to do to answer your question is that we as black people, man, have always had an ancestral tradition appropriate for the time. That's how we got through it, man. That's how we got through the Middle Passage. How we got through slavery. How we got through, you know, we've always had a tradition to get us through that time. Unfortunately, we're probably at the weakest point that I've seen in my brief history on the planet, is that these things that go on today, man, is that it's hard for me, and that's why you said from my perspective and my vantage point, the view from Pompey's head, I can't see or understand some of it. That's why I don't try to give too much direction. You know? I can't understand how someone would celebrate using a term or terms that's the most denigrating terms that you could use, man. Calling our women hoes and bitches and calling each other niggers. Them are demeaning terms. And you can't sanitize that. You cannot deconstruct what somebody else constructed. So that word, or those words, so much disrespect for our females, for our women, and so much low self-esteem and self-hate. How you gonna talk about niggers being a term of endearment? It's really interesting, man. It's interesting. You know that you familiar with Hungarians?
Hungarians
call themselves, what they call them, funky.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Jews call themselves kites.
Right.
Latins call themselves they're six. Italians are wops and dagos. Chinese are cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese are Japs. Germans are Kraut. You don't hear no German come talking about calling them all each other Kraut and celebrating it.
Mm.
We celebrate that nonsense, man.
Mm.
And personally, I don't care what people think or believe about that. But that's why I don't deal with no aspects of the N word. I say nigger, because it's a negative term. And I want the power of that negativeness to be dealt with. I don't want to deal with a euphemism.
Mm.
But if they don't use the N-word, what's the N-word? Now? Never? Those are N-words. But when you hear somebody say, well, I don't use the N-word, what are they talking about?
Mm.
They know what they're talking about. So they're playing some games with something that's serious.
Mm-hmm.
After the last word that was heard by the people of this country when they're being lynched is nigger.
Mm-hmm.
Before this, that's a blood-soaked term. It's the last word they heard. And you're going to try to sanitize that and talk about, and I just told you about this other group, they don't go around celebrating the negative term. But that's what's happening in this country, and this country has facilitated it, man. So all of the negative stuff you see these young people doing, man, that's if it was a barcode, Bobby, on some of the negative stuff that black people are doing, if it was a barcode on it, it would be stamped Made in America.
So, you're 84 years young. What keeps you engaged in the struggle?
The struggle. I struggle every day with it. I see it every day. I live it every day. And like I said, I'm not romanticizing it. I'm not romanticizing it. I know the deal just like you know the deal. I live in a nice community, got a nice home. Got a nice car. My wife and I were coming home the other night at 4 a.m. from a jazz club up in New York. And I'm a block and a half away from my house, man. I get pulled over by the police.
A block and a half from your house.
That's right. This was 2 weeks ago, man.
Let me see your ID.
Right. He said, let me see your ID. let me see your driver's license, your insurance. I give him my driver's license. He goes to the car and he comes back. He said, this is a true story, man. He said, your right wheel crossed the line on the side of the street. So I thought he might be drunk or something.
Oh, my.
So what he did, he said, well, now that I know that you know what he wanted to know, he saw my license, and he knew I lived in this community. But that's what he told me. So you asked me what keeps me sharp, is that Ali'll tell you what keeps you sharp. But Ali, what's the last thing they tell Ali when he's boxing? What's the umpire say?
Protect yourself at all times.
Protect yourself at all times.
Yes, sir.
That's what keeps me sharp. Keep my jab up. When I go out there, I know what's going on. So I got to be conscious of what's going on. So I don't get lulled to sleep in none of that crazy stuff, you know.
So
keep your jab up, man. And you protect yourself at all times.
As an iconic figure, whether you recognize yourself as that or not, what parting remarks would you please share with my audience?
Well, I think that the best I could come up with is just try to be the best human being you can be. That's very important to me, being the best human being you can be. And don't let anyone make you believe or think that you're less than the best human being. So I don't buy into all of that other stuff. That all those other myths, man. There's too many myths in the society for the country, man. Is that they want you to buy into? I don't know if you've ever been to Philadelphia, but Philadelphia ain't no city of brotherly love. That's what they'll tell you. They'll tell you that, and if you believe it, you know. So that's just be the best human being you can be and help other human beings. And that is basically what that group that you're talking about was trying to do. We're just trying to be the best human being we could be. And we brought individuals together to do that. And then people abandoned all of their egos, man, and self-righteousness. And I'm not trying to be self-righteous. I'm just trying to tell you that's who I am. And I don't make all of the right moves and understand it, you know. Because I have flaws. But I'm not going to let anybody chump me off on some stuff. And I ain't going to let nobody get to believe something that you're not. The one thing that I want to say, man, is that I know how to think. To read is good, to do that other stuff is good, but to think is better.
Well,
understand that.
Well, Brother Beach, before I conclude this interview, I want you to know that I will be staying more engaged with you because we got a big battle coming up in Canton, Ohio over the construction of the new Hall of Fame Village. It's a $1 billion construction project, and as we speak right now, there's very little black contracting participation. And being someone who's familiar with that area, and you know some of the people that I want to reach out to, including Willie Davis, and some people that I'm not thinking of right now that are in the Hall of Fame that you may have access to, because through my relationship with the National Association of Minority Contractors and a brother by the name of Norman Edwards, who's on the front line pitching and waging the war against that inequity, I will definitely be getting back to you, man. And as I close out, I'd like to say, man, thank you so much, brother, for spending this time with me and being a living example of what it means to live a life of purpose and a mission-driven man. So thank you so much, man, for joining me on Uncle Bobby's Country Corner.
Appreciate it, man. And I want to thank you for the things that you're doing. And the things that you're doing is very, very beneficial, man, and whatever I can do. I don't take the position like a lot of people, man, that they can only do, you can only do their thing. What I'm doing, and whatever you're doing, I can help you do it, even if it's in a small way.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, man, and I'll be in touch with you soon. If wherever you at listening to this show right now, in some way, it doesn't even have to be a physical gesture, but salute this brother, man. He's one of the finest individuals that's ever walked this earth. And he's been consistent in his steadfastness about uplifting the people of his hue. So, again, man, thank you so much for joining me tonight, Brother Beach, and I'll be talking with you soon.
All right. Thank you, Bobby. Peace and love, man.
All right. In my final comments for this evening, I want to go back and address a special edition I did of the Uncle Bobby's Country Corner on Saturday with a friend of mine by the name of Jason Whitlock. And some of the things that that Brother Beach just said is important for me to articulate from my vantage point in terms of how I define friendship. Jason Whitlock has been a friend of mine for 12 years, and some of the things that he has done that he doesn't get credit for and hasn't asked credit for is the reason I value his voice. Not so much his voice, but his actions. Several years ago, Playboy magazine commissioned Jason Whitlock to do a piece. There's supposed to have been a puff piece about the correctional institutions around the country. And what he produced, if you get a chance and you need to take the time to read that, it's a blueprint for what happened to this nation long before the movie 13. And his position on that would not be consistent with what you think of him. So I caution folks at this moment, be careful about aspersions and taking somebody else's opinion of who somebody is. Not just Jason Whitlock, it's a lot of people that fit into that category. And you don't always have to agree with people, but we all have to always show some measure of respect towards each other, because at the end of the day, the bigger fight is not between us. It's about what's right for you as an individual, for you as your community, and for us as a nation, be it black, white, or otherwise. And I think it's important also to know that we spend a lot of time talking and very little time engaging in problem solving and making better decisions. And my commitment with this show each week is to present to you models of possibility and best practice. And tonight was evidence of that, to have an opportunity to speak for nearly an hour with a man who walked through a period of American history that wasn't anything close to a joke. And so if we gain anything from the show tonight, that is, everybody's got 24 hours, 7 days in a week, 365 days in a year. It matters what you do with each and every moment. So I want to thank Sister Portis for once again allowing me to sit in this studio right down here on Crenshaw Boulevard, also known as Morris Media Studio, where we recycling black dollars. Thank you for letting me be myself again. See you next week.